Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses for an audience of real entrepreneurs. And joining me today is a guest who, before we started, said, dude, push me, push my buttons. I said, wow, most people tell me to back off. Good. Karn, you were going to say something as I said that.
Yeah, man, let's keep it interesting.
You don't want a weak interview, right? Where the person is slavishly excited about the guest.
Right.
Exactly. I have to be honest. Sometimes I am excited about the guest story so much that I do come across as a little bit too eager. Mm-hmm. All right. Karn Soroya, whose voice you just heard, is an entrepreneur who started a fashion business and then he sold it. And then he started this company that will let you insure just about anything you could take a picture of. And that's about it. The new company is called Cover, and he actually even owns the domain name, cover.com, which tells you he's got a lot of VC money to throw around, right? When you're in a hustler stage, you get carnapp.com. No, coverapp.com. All right, this interview is sponsored by two companies you probably are so tired of hearing me talk about, but damn it, I'm going to keep doing it because it works and you guys love them. The first will let you hire phenomenal developers. It's called TopTal, and the second will help you host your website, right? It's called HostGator. I got a complaint on Twitter about why HostGator is sponsoring. I'm going to talk about that later. But first, Karn, how much money did you raise for Cover?
So far, we've raised about $27 million.
How's that feel to you?
You know, it's a drop in the bucket in insurance, that's for sure. You know, we're pretty capital efficient so far as insurance businesses go. We've been able to accomplish a lot with the amount of money Geico spends, you know, in like about half an hour.
So when I compare it to other VC, when I compare it to your last company or compare it to other tech startups, and it seems like a lot, you're saying, hey, compare it to insurance companies. And the reason for that is what? Where does the money go in insurance?
Well, most insurance companies, at least the top ones that you know of, aren't really venture backed, right? Like they've kind of snowballed into these like monolithic, huge entities that spin off tons of free cash flow. And so you're talking about like, hey, generating $20 billion in free cash flow. Geico does that on an annualized basis. So when it comes to most of InsurTech and actually, you know, even us, like these are trivial sums, right? I mean, I think of it as a fairly small number.
How much revenue do you make? That's the number I always get excited about.
Yeah, I mean, we're running at about $1 million in net new premium a month. We think we're probably going to scale to about $10 million a month.
A million in what?
In net new premium per month.
Premium. Uh-huh.
Correct. Yeah. So that means like a customer pays us a dollar. That dollar is then used to settle claims, operating expenses, you know, cost of acquisition.
And what's the difference between net new premium and just overall premiums?
That's just the new premium that we're adding. So insurance itself, you know, the beauty of it is a super sticky, you know, intangible product with very predictable cash flows. And so net new is the thing that we measure, to keep track of what our growth is rather than our recurring renewal book.
What would recurring renewal be?
Yeah, so think about it this way, like you pay for car insurance.
No, I mean, how much is the, if you were just to look at your overall revenue,
right,
monthly, what would that be?
Oh, so for us, we've been selling insurance for maybe a year and a half, so it's not a huge number. Our net new is tracking, as a proportion of our overall premium, the vast majority of it at this point.
Got it. So we're basically looking at a $12 million a year revenue business, but it's growing at $1 million new premium dollars coming in every month.
Correct. And our target over the course of the next basically 14 months is to get to something in the range of $8 to $10 million in net new premium per month. That's the goal.
Got it. You're a guy who you told our producer, look, I, to get here, had to hear a lot of no's, and it started right when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I like that you are a door-to-door salesman, but I've never heard anyone sell what you sold. What did you sell?
I mean, I've sold light bulbs, so like LED light bulbs when those are relatively novel. I've sold water coolers, subscriptions to water coolers. I sold knives at some point. I was one of those ghetto kids where, you know, the white truck would pull up and you'd sell you know, chocolate, but not for school purposes.
Oh, you were just buying the chocolate, giving the impression that it was for school, but you were making all the profit on it.
No. I wasn't even that. Like, I was just being taken advantage of as child labor. So no. I sold chocolate door to door, but not for school. I sold World Wildlife Fund subscriptions. What else did I sell? All sorts of crazy things.
Can I ask you about your bracelet?
Yeah, sure.
Is it a religious bracelet?
Yeah. So I'm in Jakarta. I'm Punjabi. I'm not a practicing Sikh. I wear it mostly because my mom asks me to wear it.
What's the significance of the bracelet for Sikhs? That's one way that you can tell people are Sikhs. They cut their hair. You cut your hair now, right? You got a really nice shave. Do you feel like you've turned your back on your religion and your people by doing that?
Have I turned my back on my religion and my people?
You told me to go heavy.
No, I mean, like there are like five or so, maybe six things that Sikh people wear to signify, like, you know, their faith. They wear a kara, they wear kirpan, which is like a small dagger. You know, amongst other things, they don't cut their hair, they don't eat meat, they're not supposed to drink, a bunch of these things. I just wear the kara. That's like what I do. The backstory behind, you know, me not having my hair long or not being a vegetarian is basically, you know, I got fed up. When I was little, I had a turban. Like I got fed up with it because my hair was like down to like, you know, my ass for most of my youth.
Yeah.
And that's like impossible to manage. It was just super painful. And so one day, I mean, I was so fed up with it that I just went to the barber and got my hair cut. Without telling my parents, and I took my little brother too. And at the same time, I got both of my ears pierced.
Wow.
Just because I figured that there was, you know, probably some like asymptotic limit to the amount of shit that I would get into with my parents.
So you might as well combine it.
You might as well combine it. Got it done. Haven't looked back since. Certainly manageable. So far as monotheistic religions go, you know, Sikhism's legit. I just don't practice.
The ability to cut off of the past like that is a real hard challenge. Like, for example, I had my lights set up in a nice way over here. My leg's hurting, so I sat down. To just like take away the perfection of the light as it was when I was standing up and adjust it so that it's down and know that I'm never going to get it back the perfect way. It's a hard thing. It seems like you like that. You relish that. You start it with like fashion. You're totally fine with it. You decide it's going to be insurance. You're fine cutting off all your fashion experience, all your e-commerce connections and starting back fresh and being a brand new one. You're okay with that. That's who you are.
Yeah. I think, look, like, I like to say that everything is compost, right? Like there are a set of experiences you have, either professionally or personally that, you know, can be instructive or at least helpful, to you as you go on and you do the next set of things that you want to do with your life. Right. And so when it came to e-commerce, specifically StyleKick, I mean, we sold high-end fashion on the internet, specifically on a small screen. You know, we'd have designers and influencers and lookbookers upload outfits. We'd make individual pieces shoppable.
You know what? I'm gonna take some time to go through that story for a moment. I just want to pause on what you said before. Everything is compost. So what you're saying is, look, I have all these experiences in the past. The fact that I throw them away doesn't mean that I've let go of them. The fact that I'm not in the style business anymore doesn't mean that it's not helping me and now I've started from zero like a baby. No, that's compost. That's nourishing this new business. And you told our producer several times, here's the mistake that I made before. Here's how I'm smarter. I'm not making that same mistake again. And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, you know, when we're running StyleKick, we'll get into it, but it was a million active users, right? And we were, you know, fairly infatuated with the fact that we're adding 10,000 new people a day, without really giving much thought to, you know, what the underlying unit economics of that e-commerce business could look like, you know, at scale or whether that would be sustainable. And so, you know, we'll get into it, but the crux of it was this, like, the learnings from building a e-commerce fashion business, and e-commerce is difficult, right? It's just super hard. Unless you're focused on building a vertically integrated brand or, you know, in the selling things like Wish or Amazon in the impulse price, like purchase range. And so we learned how to build beautiful products and we learned how to drive millions of people through those products, right? And those are valuable skills irrespective of which vertical.
Yeah. So StyleKick. Let's spend some time on StyleKick before we move over to Cover. StyleKick was something that you started when you were a grad student at NYU. You looked at these scanners or the sensors that you guys had in the school. And what were these sensors supposed to do? And how did they shape your vision that eventually became this company?
Yeah. So it was after I was a grad student at MIT, I was a management consultant. And then I gave up management consulting to build, which in retrospect, something that was like not obvious and kind of dumb. We built body scanners. So we use the Kinect sensor, which is effectively a depth sensor and a webcam combination. We use three of them, so 3 points of perspective, to shave away, to first create a body form, because you have 3 points of perspective, you have a depth sensor and a webcam on each of these things. And then we use math to shave away clothes, so we get like point-to-point measurements on a human being. And we thought that would help us inform sizing decisions for online purchases. That's what we thought, right?
Meaning what? That people would actually go into these body scanners, and then once they knew their real size, they'd be able to go and buy online.
Yeah.
And you'd have these scanners where?
Exactly, right? So we were thinking about what's the distribution look like for something.
Okay.
Right? And so, a quick logical check would have been, well, the natural candidate for distribution for something like this would be, hey, like a mall, right? You walk into a Gap and maybe they have one of these things. And we talked to the Gap and we talked to all of these like major brands. And the reality is, it's like, this just not conform to what, you know, consumers would want to do. It doesn't conform to buying behavior in store. And frankly, it was a little bit creepy, right? So there were a couple of companies that were working on this. And really, if there was any sort of lift to be seen, there probably would have been a war for mall space in America. And there wasn't, specifically for scanners. And so we stepped back and we were thinking about like, what is it actually that we're trying to build? Here, and we were trying to build something that allowed folks or something that predicted how folks wanted to buy. So this is around like price point, styles, structural elements of clothing, colors, like the specific attributes that people cared about and tended to gravitate towards. And so we built this very simple app, and it's like our story building StyleKick and Cover is pretty similar, but it was like a weekend hackathon. We scraped a bunch of outfits from like Lookbook and Pinterest and like whatever, reformatted this content into full screen outfits that you could double tap. Like you could double tap individual parts of an outfit to indicate you like that part of an outfit. And you could scroll through like an endless stream of basically this content.
So if I used your software, what I would do is see just a bunch of photos that you scraped from online, which means that they're probably well done, right? The clothes in it. And what you want to see is, which shirt do I like, or do you want to see which combination I liked?
No, we wanted to see the individual items as you liked as part of that outfit, right?
Okay, you go ahead. We're talking about
you could have double tapped like a blouse or a handbag or a pair of jeans. And, at the test phases, all we were trying to do is see if people were interacting with the content, period, right? When we launched it, we climbed the App Store like rankings. We were like number one for style in like France and like a bunch of other countries. And we saw this like behavior that was interesting to us. And so then what we inevitably did was like made it a marketplace where we had influencers, designers, lookbookers upload their outfits. So we maintained the quality of the content that was on the platform. And then we built out this like tagging functionality that basically allowed them to tag individual outfits and the attributes associated with those outfits. And so when a customer double tapped on that piece or whatever it was, the next set of pieces or outfits that we showed them would be informed by what they'd interacted with. So we would know like roughly what price point you're looking at. We would have a sense of what colors you liked.
Clever.
Like if you like Mandarin collars, for example, we show you Mandarin collars.
Right.
So it's pretty cool. We got tons of engagement because of
how did you get people to even notice that this thing exists, let alone just go in and start to thumbs up outfits without knowing that someone else on the other side is going to feel complimented by that?
Right. I think we use a portfolio approach to growth like we do with anything. So a confluence of influencer marketing, because we're thinking about, hey, where are our customers actually? Our customers are lifestyle, like are the the people that we're speaking to, our customers, are lifestyle influencers on YouTube and Instagram and fashion influencers. And so we worked pretty aggressively with influencers very early.
When you say worked with them aggressively, you mean you paid them to promote this app?
Correct.
Got it. You paid them. They promoted the app. Their users went to get the app to see a bunch of photos of outfits. They double tapped whatever they liked, just like they did on Instagram. Yep. You had a sense of what they wanted to buy or what they were more likely to buy. And then you start selling them right away?
Yeah, we were selling. We were selling in Sawkick. So how did you get...
I'm constantly pausing you because I want to just take a long time to really go through every bit of it. I see now how you got people to use it. How did you get the money to pay for these influencers? Did you raise money at that point?
No, so we were kind of, we'd raised a small sum from a set of angels, but nothing significant.
How much?
We're talking maybe like $125,000 at that point. And so, you know, we were a little early with influencer marketing, right? And so the genius of what we were doing was we weren't working with top tier influencers. We weren't working with like the people with millions of followers because we knew implicitly that we couldn't afford to work with them. The market is efficient and the price for eyeballs is correctly priced, right? Like, and so what we did intuitively understand was that second tier influencers, like folks with a couple hundred thousand followers in and around that time, didn't actually know the value of their distribution. Right. And so for us, it was an arbitrage opportunity because we could message an influencer and be like, here's like $20 to $50 to do a sponsored post. And that's unheard of now. Like, most of the influencer market is efficiently priced. And we were driving, like 2 cent, 3 cent installs.
Wow. How did you know this? You don't strike me. By the way, I'm watching you. You're well dressed. I pointed out that even your beard is well groomed, even though you're traveling right now. But you don't strike me as someone who cares about fashion that much. How'd you even know who the influencers were or care enough to build this company?
I think the honest truth is I actually didn't care that much, right? One of my co-founders who is my fiance was working for Russell Simmons as part of his fashion group at the time. And she joined us as a co-founder and it was largely driven by her interest in the business and mostly our excitement around growing so quickly. Right. So that's like, that was it. I mean, I didn't have any particular, affinity towards high end fashion. Like I didn't own a pair of $300 jeans, though we sold pairs of $300 jeans. That was it. I think like we kind of pivoted our way into this thing that was working and we're trying to scale it.
All right. And you were starting to say how you got revenue. You were selling your own products or affiliate?
No. It was entirely affiliate. Yeah. In retrospect, I think we could have made it work. The folks who did win out in this space. Before I walk into who would have won, I'll answer your question in and around like how did we come up with this stuff, the non-intuitive second tier influencers. I think we're particularly creative, coming up with, and starting with a baseline question of where are our customers and working backwards from there, right? And so a good example of that is actually Cover. And the most recent one is like we if you go to driving.cover.com, you'll see that we set up a defensive driving school. And the reason for that is, right now, people use defensive driving schools to access insurance discounts or remove violations from their records. And they have to pay for these things typically, right? Like 25 to like $150. And then you get your 10% discount or a violation knocked off of your record. But we're a tech company. Right? Literally, this is courseware. And so what we did was we built out a simple defensive driving school to enable our customers to unlock access to these discounts that save them material amounts of money. Right? Again, like where are our customers? Our customers are performing these particular behaviors or like using these particular products. Well, as a tech company, how can we super high leverage and find a path into them? Right. And so it turns out, and we didn't even know this at the start, in Texas, just Texas, there are 480,000 people who went through a defensive driving school over the course of the last 18 months. If you think about that in the context of insurance, the LTV of our customers is thousands of dollars, right? 480,000 people looking for a free, like a course they would otherwise have to pay for and find
right.
is huge. So again, like it starts with, where are our customers? How can we access them in non-obvious ways? And that is like, I think one of the things that I look for in other entrepreneurs is like, do you have like the skill set to surgically acquire these customers and be able to identify, you know, venues for getting in touch with them that are not obvious and show a level of creativity that is not like.
Who else does this well? What's another example of doing this well? This is brilliant. One of the things that's brilliant about it is you're publishing driving.cover.com on Teachable. There's no software. All you did was Teachable. This is the same thing that people use to teach anything. So what's another example that you do like that, of this surgical precision, finding your customers in a way that other people wouldn't, either that you have done or that you admire someone else for doing well?
Yeah. So the other things that we're thinking about doing, because, you know, like we get access to driver history reports, you get access to vehicle reports, you get access to credit. This is actually kind of Credit Karma-esque, right? It's like if we're using all of these third-party APIs to be able to fill in an underwriting application programmatically, and that's part of our value proposition, why not just make this information available to our customers, right? Like, why not just be like, hey, Andrew, like, do you want to know what your vehicle history is? You probably don't have a full sense if you have a used car. Or do you want to know, what the insurance companies actually rate you on? Like, well, here it is, right? And so like, think of it as like, there are a set of tools that are intended to add value and are ancillary to like the way that we make money, right? We actually saw this when we were acquihired in Shopify. You know, they did this, a lot of this, and it was, hey, let's create a logo generator, right? Because folks who are interested in starting a store on Shopify are going to need a logo, right? Let's create a business name generator, because people who want to start a store on Shopify need a business name.
And then once you generate your logo or store name, you're directed to Shopify to publish.
Right.
About to give another example, and I interrupted you. What was it?
Or we need stock photography, right? For our store, and so they created that. Like, all of the things that were, you know, pre-commerce, right? Funneled into their, we're setting up a store and becoming an e-commerce entity file, right? Similarly, we think of it as like, what does pre-insurance look like, right?
Right.
So it's like, hey, like, here are the things that you care about. Insurance itself is not a particularly sexy thing, but there are lots of things that are in or around insurance that are pretty interesting. And ultimately, we sell insurance, right?
Look at this, burst.shopify.com, stock photos
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. You built up this app. I can see how it was growing. I could see how you got users. Was there any virality in it to get to a million active users? I can't imagine it's just you guys reaching out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we were really good at ASO. So, you know, we ramped
App Store acquisition. Yeah. What is it?
So App Store optimization.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, we built a really beautiful, like if the product wasn't great, I don't think we would have gotten there. Right. It was a beautiful product. And it was featured in just about every country that the App Store supported, and translated into 14 languages. Dominated most of the keywords related to fashion and style. And generally speaking, picked up tons of organic traffic. So certainly that, and then like the typical things that you would expect: really good referral mechanisms, really good content sharing mechanisms. Thinking about what the happy moments were as part of the product experience to drive.
What was a happy moment?
I don't know, like a purchase is a happy moment, right?
Or
like,
and so that's when you might want to share that you bought something.
Yeah, or like a lookbooker or a designer. Lookbooker or designer has now a bunch of new followers because there was a following element to it, or had a bunch of new likes. And you pop up a dialogue that says, hey, what do you think is nostalgic? Like 1 out of 5 stars, right? So like, and those things all kind of fact, like you've seen these patterns before, right? They all kind of bubble up into visibility, generally speaking.
All right, let me take a moment and tell you that on Twitter, somebody said, Andrew, I really like your stuff and I respect it, but what are you doing talking about HostGator as a hosting company? And I realized, Karin, there's this whole like snob and endless arguing over what a great hosting company is. Instead of getting deep into that argument, let me tell you about a guy named Ron Gula, who I interviewed recently about how he started a company called Tenable, took it public, got it to over $2 billion in value. He then said, I'm stepping away. I'm going to become an angel investor full time. He's running Gula Tech Adventures. That's adventures, not ventures. That's his thing.
Okay.
And his website is on freaking HostGator. Just keep it basic. What I've noticed is wannabe podcasters will tell you endlessly about gold-plated cables that you connect your mic to the computer that are never meant to be coiled up because then they ruin the experience and the sound quality, and they spend endlessly talking about that. Real podcasters just freaking plug a good mic in and they get into the conversation instead of into the detail of how much gold is in the freaking wires. Same thing here with websites. We could talk endlessly about the best hosting company on the planet. I have no doubt that many people are going to say HostGator is not the best, that there might be other better. I'm not into that. Just go fucking get a hosting company to host your website and get on with the business. And when it comes to hosting companies, HostGator is better than good enough. It just freaking works. They're not going to come over to your house and give you massages. They're not going to give you free stock photography even, right? Frankly, they just work. That's all they give you. And it's inexpensive and it's been there forever. So you know you can count on them. In fact, if you go to hostgator.com/Mixergy, you'll get a lower price than they will give anywhere else. And you'll get tagged as a Mixergy customer, which means you'll get our backing. And when you're ready to scale up, they will scale up with you. Do what Ron Gula, do what I, do what so many other entrepreneurs have done. Stop fucking worrying about your hosting company. Get one that works really well and worry about where your customers are and how you're going to improve your product. That should be their freaking motto. I don't think they like that I curse. They really have a very mainstream. They don't like that I curse. I never curse in there. I just get so frustrated. I'm not calling out that guy on Twitter intentionally. Uh-huh. Don't want him to feel like I don't like him. I like when people say, Andrew, tell me, I'm challenging you about the sponsor. I want to only have the best. So keep challenging me. I will never embarrass you or be upset with you for doing it. But I got to tell you, I put a lot of thought into the sponsors. And in the case of HostGator, I'm really happy to be working with them. Proud to recommend them. If you're looking for a hosting company, go to hostgator.com/Mixergy and never ask me about them in public because apparently I get spitting. I start to spit up when I get excited about them. And I promise I will never spit up when I talk in public.
I appreciate your enthusiasm.
Thank you. I want to keep it real. Keeping it real, baby. All right. I saw how you were building up and we were starting to get to the sale. Before we get into the sale of Shopify, you told our producer, look, the big problem was we were getting people to buy. They just weren't buying outfits through our app because...
Mm-hmm. Look, like so first of all, to be clear, it was an acquihire. Like our team was absorbed in and we ended up running a mobile product unit. And that was cool. And got to work with Toby and...
the founder of Shopify, very famous developer.
The first day, which actually pretty cool. And then, who's now the CPO, Craig Miller, and Satish, who's awesome as a GM there. So look, like at the end of the day, we were still operating on 3.5 and 4 inch screens and we were selling super high value items. And inevitably what was happening was people were, and we were observing this behavior, just like taking screenshots of products or taking screenshots of outfits and emailing them to themselves to complete the purchase or the rest of like their research process on a desktop experience, right? I think mobile has kind of evolved to the point where, you know, if you have enough comfort, with a particular type of purchase, you probably will transact, but conversion rates on native mobile are probably still lagging the desktop experience. Like there are interesting outliers now in e-commerce, like Goat, for example. It's very specific. It's like, hey, like we're going to sell you like, super cool sneakers, sometimes below dead stock prices. And that's going to be the hook, even though you're spending $300 on a pair of sneakers. But the winners that evolved or came out of our era of e-commerce were effectively folks like Wish, right? Or folks like Glossier who focus on a specific product line. And so Wish was like, okay, well, Danny, one of the co-founders of Wish, was one of the first investors in Cover because we got to know him. Over time. The beauty behind the Wish model is like they serve, most of the country that's not coastal, right? And like most of the country that's not coastal can be pretty price sensitive. And so, when you're thinking about, do I want to pull the trigger on this like $5 to $10 item? And perhaps it takes a little bit longer to ship. And like, perhaps there's some variability in the quality of the item that gets to me. Like, well, at the end of the day, I don't really care that much. It's a $5 thing and I buy it. And that's it, right? And so conversion rates are much higher for impulse price purchases. And so you can kind of get this like spin wheel going where your LTV is persistently higher than your CAC and you can build a sizable business like Wish, right? similarly, like you have these end-to-end, you know, product companies that were also built off of influencer marketing. And there are like really great examples of that that are still popping up.
Like right? What was the example you gave earlier?
I don't know which one I gave earlier, but like there are a ton of these like Triangle, which is like swimwear. I mean, Glossier that sells makeup. Gymshark that sells, basically fitness wear. There are tons of these like very specific, like vertical approaches to product that ended up winning that use very similar tactics to grow, right? That we used to grow Stylekick.
I'm on Glossier right now. I never heard of them before, but now I see it's still not as expensive as your products. I'm looking at lipstick for $18. That might be more expensive than the local drugstore, but we're not talking about a $300 outfit.
Correct. Yeah.
What about this? If you saw that people were buying it on the desktop, would you have been able to save those sales by just having them hit a save button that automatically emailed it to themselves?
We actually did start doing that, right? So we went down the path of building out stylekick.com to be able to basically facilitate the transaction on a desktop experience. I think it was just, we just got to a point where, you know, I think we were running, I've said this before, but like, I think we were running out of steam in and around like our desire to be building that particular business, right? And we had a running conversation relationship with Shopify, who was trying to build out, some of the mobile products that they had been lagging, there for some time. And we were really good at building product, and there weren't that many, you know, people who were really great at building consumer facing.
So they bought you to build their software, and so, not because they liked your software, not because they wanted Stylekick.
No. It was a team acquisition.
They wanted the team.
Yeah. And so, I mean, like we went there and we built out experimental marketplace apps. We helped out with them building out the Facebook Messenger chatbot for commerce.
How did that work for them? Facebook Messenger chatbot for commerce?
I don't think very well. Like, I think, I don't know if they still support this thing, but I think the reality is, and this is somewhat tangential, but those types of tools, like those chatbot tools, are not great for sales origination. Like, it's hard to sell via chatbot. It is great for sales and servicing and cross-sell, right? So like if on a Shopify store, you had just bought beef jerky, for example, right? And you for some reason authenticated in via Facebook or had sent them a message via Messenger, and you got a follow-up message a couple of days later being like, hey, hope you really enjoyed that beef jerky. Here's 50% off of your next purchase. Like, that works, right?
Right.
Like it doesn't work when it's like, here's some beef jerky via Messenger.
I've noticed that too. If it's like a menu replacing a website, people aren't eager to go into Facebook Messenger to start shopping.
Yeah.
But if I was thinking of it as like Messenger marketing, drip marketing, where if I see you're interested in jerky, I might tell you how I'm making this jerky today, tell you the difference between our healthy jerky and other jerky, et cetera. And then a week later say, by the way, I made extra jerky at my place this month. I'm going to send it to you for 50% off. You got to buy now.
Yeah, I think like just messaging as a platform tends to work better with someone who has familiarity with you or has already transacted with you, right? It's just like, just way easier to sell to people who have already bought from you. Right. And like Messenger can facilitate that kind of transaction. And this might just be a personal thing. I just find it too spammy. If it's anything other than
that is a bit of an issue.
Yeah.
But so what I'm sensing is you got to learn a lot. They basically hired you guys and taught you how to create software fast, how to think about getting customers.
I think we already had those skills. Like, we were valuable to Shopify because we had those skills.
Because
right?
you knew how to get those customers.
Yeah.
And so what's an example of how you helped them get customers while you were there?
Yeah. So look, like, I think we weren't on the growth team. So we weren't doing that. I mean, we were certainly weighing in on some of the strategies that we had used to drive top of the funnel. But like, we were working on apps like that eventually evolved into, and this was like a couple iterations in, like there were other product managers working on this, but like Frenzy, which is like a drop app, right? So it's like, oh, we're dropping a sale of like Yeezy Boosts, like on this particular corner. And like, there's a way to grow like a following around that and actually get people to interact in like real life. But that's very far from like where we started. What we actually tried to do, when we were at Shopify was build out, something called Pop-Up, which was, which was intended to be like a Wish-esque competitor, because we saw Wish working. And you had basically this entire Shopify product catalog of things that were sold by, you know, hundreds of thousands of merchants. And inevitably, you know, for sure, there were in very, very interesting products that were, again, in that impulse price purchase range, right?
Yeah.
And so we built that out. And then lo and behold, I mean, on weekends, we were still running hackathons because we had the itch. And we knew we wanted to build another mobile product. We knew that.
When you say we, you mean you and your co-founders, while you were working at Shopify, doing all the software that you just mentioned, experimenting constantly, you were also going home on the weekends and creating your own hackathons just for you.
Yeah, that's great.
Your sit down, let's code something type of thing, because you had an itch to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah. I mean, what we recognized was we build great product and we know how to acquire tons of customers. There are a very finite set of human beings on earth that can actually do that, right? Like, let's be clear. Like, both of those things are hard. And we were like, okay, well, we can do this and we can do this right now. It's temporal. So let's go do this. And so we would, drive up to Northern Ontario on the weekends and we would have some beers and we would shoot the shit on what we could be doing, right?
Like what? I've seen some lists of it. What stands out for you that you remember?
Yeah, so we tried a bunch of things. Like, we tried stuff in healthcare. We thought about entertainment again. We came up with this like crazy idea called Turnip, which was like a play on turn up. And that was like a list, like a venues app that allowed college students to list their keggers and their like purple Jesus parties locally. So if you were in a college town, you'd pop it open and you'd find the kegger that you wanted to attend and you'd pay and you'd go. And we eventually thought that we would, people do this, they find keggers. And so we would eventually layer on real venues to be able to like monetize this meaningfully, like a nightclub. Yep. And then we just stepped back and we decided, hey, this is probably not something we want to build for a very long time. And then we thought up like a lottery app, so Lotto Loop.
Tell me about that. I saw that, I think, in a TechCrunch article. I saw it on a podcast that you were part of. Yeah. What was that lottery app?
Yeah. So actually, like, I mean, we didn't take it all the way, but it was pretty simple. It was like Natalie's mom would drive from Toronto to Buffalo whenever the Powerball lottery was above like $600 million, right? Or I think I think they're much bigger now, but like back then it was
okay. That range. I'm with you.
And we were like, okay, well, lotteries are money losing propositions, like period. You're just not going to win. Okay. Probabilistically. But also factor in like the opportunity cost of your time moving from Toronto to like going from Toronto to Buffalo to get these tickets. Plus the gas, plus wear and tear on your vehicle. Like, there must be a simpler way to allow foreign nationals to participate in a lottery, right? And there are actually good examples of this existing. This is a real business, and this happens. But you can hold lottery tickets in trust, right? Like, you can park up in like Michigan and like buy 1,000 lottery tickets from a specific vendor and charge a markup and, you know, have a simple tool or app that scans in the lottery ticket. You hold in trust for the Russians or the Canadians or the whomever are interested in participating. And actually, I think that's a business. I actually think there like should be more efficient lotteries. And I think, if you want to participate in a lottery, you should just be able to. But again, we step back and we're like, okay, is this something that we want to spend another 5 or 6 years of our lives working on? The answer again is no.
And that was a big, by the way, speaking of lottery, just reminded me, I started a site called grab.com. We offered the world's first $1 billion jackpot. Warren Buffett backed it.
Yeah.
But it was advertising based and I wanted to get to subscription based. So I was thinking, what could we do to sell lottery tickets without breaking the law and becoming a gambling hall online, which would get me into jail? And I thought about it. I said, we continue to let people play for free on our website. But if they want my software to auto enter them so they never miss a contest and maybe do it several times into my system, that is $10 a month. And that started kicking in a little bit of money. And I ran it by a bunch of lawyers to make sure it was good. And it was kicking in a good amount of money. What we were missing was there's some like element of, I have to win the lottery. That's important. People who want to win the lottery aren't looking for software to hack the system and get a chance to win. They're looking for, I scratch it off and I get it, or I pick my numbers or something.
Right.
And once you let them pick the numbers, they want to come back and do it again. But still, it was kicking off enough money and it was legal. That was pretty good.
How much did you pay for grab.com?
$100,000, I think, at the time.
Sounds like a steal.
It was a steal. It was a great domain. Good also for like television, and people would remember it and go from a radio show and go type it in.
Do you still own it, or did you sell it to Grab?
I actually sold it to the company that ended up owning MySpace, or that owned MySpace. And then they sold it to another company that turned it into a gaming site. Let's just say like a standalone game site. And then it became something I go to Indonesia and I see Grab is what you use for cabs. Like experience. How much did you get from your acqui-hire?
I mean, it was a sizable pool of RSUs. It was fine. Like it was acceptable.
Did you become a millionaire from that?
I think, given how Shopify's stock has performed, I think that would have been pretty significant. Like I could have bought.
And you held on to it.
Well, we didn't invest. We lasted like 7 months in Shopify, right? Like,
you lasted only 7 months here. I have your LinkedIn profile and it didn't even occur to me. That's how fast you had to go back. So then you basically made a little bit of a bonus and that's it.
Yeah, basically. That's what happened.
Why? Do Indian parents get upset when they hear that?
Hey, man, it's hard to... I mean, first of all, Indian parents don't even know what Shopify does.
They know what stock price is.
They know what stock prices are. So do I. We had the itch and we were running these hackathons and we came across Cover. Like it was, hey, like what's the back of the envelope math in selling an insurance policy? Like, why are these insurance brokers worth billions of dollars? And they're just broke before they're even carriers, right? And the reason for it is the economics of the insurance business are incredibly attractive. Like a single auto policy in California, runs $1,700 per annum per year. A broker is going to make between 12 and 18% of that in perpetuity, right? So you're spinning off, $200 to $300 for a single policy per year for a product that churns like on a monoline, on a single line basis, like anywhere from 10 to 15%. So a single policy LTV is thousands of dollars, right? Which is why you see Geico and State Farm, bid via AdWords for every combination or permutation of insurance related keywords and like the ridiculous numbers. You're looking at like $50 to $80 per click, right? With low single digit conversion down a funnel that you can kind of see how.
From the beginning, did you think we're going to go after Geico? No, they locked up that space, but you were thinking maybe there are other products that we have that have the same economics.
Yeah.
That we can lock into but the difference is with cars and motorcycles, you have to buy insurance.
Yeah.
With an iPhone, I don't have to. And so how did you factor that in?
Yeah. So I mean, the initial premise was like, hey, fine. Like, it wasn't really much consideration given to which of these lines would become dominant. We were kind of like in this experimental phase. We were like, oh, okay, fine. Like, we'll see what our customers try and buy from us, and we'll double down on the stuff that our customers want to buy from us. We saw all sorts of crazy things, right? Like, we saw racehorses, we got tree houses, we got tanks, we got like,
You know what? We're getting into the weeds on it. Let me take a moment, and I want to go step by step again on this one. Second sponsor is a company called Top Tal. I guarantee now that you've heard them, you're going to think about them and you're going to want to use them again in the future. Let me give you an example of how a company has used Top Tal to hire developers faster and get better developers than they can get anywhere else. CSR Limited was and is a construction company. Wait, it's a global construction supply company. Let me be accurate. They were looking for a way to offer, they were looking for great developers. They wanted to digitize their supply chain and offer clients new services to improve their visibility. This was a brand new direction for them. They needed to find developers who had a strong sense of ownership, who were actually going to be able to develop and still work as a remote team. They looked around. And you know what you could do when you're trying to hire. You ask friends and friends of friends. You go online. You do all these postings. You get software that's going to help you go through all these postings and find the right company, the right hire. But it takes forever, and it's really tough to find good developers. And said, you know what? Let's go into TopTal. They went to TopTal. TopTal helped them build out an online dashboard for their customers. They were the only ones who were able to help them this way. They were the only ones who were able to help them screen for culture fit in addition to great developer qualifications. As a result of them, CSR was able to save money, help with their brand loyalty, and increase their customer retention. I don't love that story. I'll be honest with you. I've been hiring writers to improve our stories for my ads because I keep talking about TopTal. I'm reading this now on air with you, and I don't love that story. Here's what I'm going to tell you guys. If you're looking to hire developers everyone's offering the basic same thing, which is how to ask your friends or how to post job help wanted ads and then go figure out which of all the responses is good. TopTal does the opposite. They get on a call with you, they hear what you need, and then they go to their team of developers and they match you up with the perfect person or team of people. If you want to get started, you can get 80 hours of TopTal developer credit right now. In addition, if you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no-risk trial period, they're that confident that if they match you, you're going to love it. They're not even going to take money out of your pocket if you're not happy. Go to toptal.com/mixergy. Top is on top of your head. Tal is in talent. TOPTAL.com/mixergy.
Hey, man, we've used TopTal. They're legit.
You have?
Yeah, we have.
For what?
I can't remember. It's like it wasn't anything core. Like there were some ancillary stuff that we needed to get done, just needed the extra capacity. It was great.
I find that that's what a lot of people do. They don't go for core, they get extra capacity, and then sometimes they end up with the person continuing to work on an ongoing basis. Mm-hmm. All right. The first version that you created in the hackathon couldn't have been that robust. What did that first version look like?
It was terrible. So the very first version of Cover was, there were a handful of views with a preamble, take a picture of something you want to ensure. And it led to a camera view, just a typical native camera, right? And so we used our playbook, generally speaking, the one that we had built up, the compost, to drive ourselves up the rankings. So we ended up ranking number one for insurance in Canada where we launched it. We don't sell in Canada now, but we launched in Canada.
Wait, so you launched in Canada, very basic thing. You then use everything you learned about rising up the ranks in the search engine, in the App Store search engine.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay, we can do this in the rest of the country. And people are using the app to do what?
Yeah. So they're downloading the app. They're authenticating in. So we're capturing some basic information, right? And then there's like a screen or two and it says, take a picture of something you want to insure. So like people are literally sending us videos of themselves washing their cars to show pride of ownership in their vehicle because they want car insurance. They're walking us around their houses, documenting their property. We're getting engagement rings. We're getting pictures of cats and dogs and like other body parts. And all sorts of crazy things. And we're like, okay, well, we didn't think anyone would take an insurance app particularly seriously, but these people are legit trying to get insurance, right? And so at this point in time, no, we really didn't know anything about insurance distribution. All that we wanted to do was prove out that the pipe was big enough and that the consumer behavior was there, right? Usually when you uncover consumer behavior that violates your expectations, like it takes a little bit further than you would have thought, it's like that's when you double down because you've uncovered something that other people have not uncovered, right? And you can kind of build on top of that. And so off we went. I mean, like, at that point, what I did was I pinged Aaron Harris at Y Combinator, and I was like, hey, look at all this crazy stuff that's happening, like using this toy app that we built. And so he's like, oh, this is amazing. And like, I think he shared it with like another partner. Aaron doesn't sound like that, but
I get it.
So like, okay, like come in and interview for the next YC batch. I mean, we applied.
What was your connection to Aaron?
We got rejected by Y Combinator four times. First
time. Why? Yeah.
I don't think they're particularly, from a thematic point of view, great with e-commerce businesses. Like, I don't think they have a great track record of those. And I think, generally speaking, in and around the time that we applied, e-commerce businesses weren't getting funded. And so I think that's what it was. But we literally, when we applied to YC, we started with like, we have 10,000 active users. Like the next time it was like 250,000 active users. The time after that was 400,000 active users. And inevitably it's like a million. But every single time, I mean, we interviewed three times, we got rejected each time. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, I don't know what I can do to like, you know, get beyond this. But with Cover, effectively, you know, we got into Y Combinator with a prototype, right? Like we didn't have a business, like we didn't have revenue. We had a concept and we had an underlying business model that made sense, right?
Like at the time, the business model was people are taking pictures. We're now going to be like a broker, find an insurance company to.
It was even further up the funnel than that. Like we were just trying to prove the size of the, top of the funnel. And so we acted as a lead gen business. We were just selling on leads, right? And then we quickly realized that, hey, most brokerages are terrible. In fact, most carriers are terrible, right? Like they, they're not going to be interacting with our customers in the manner that we won't expect them to. As soon as we sell a lead, they're going to get spammed, right? Like phone calls, emails. And if it's not that, then it's going to be this old school broker that works maybe 5 hours a week, right? That is sitting on this huge book of business. It's like an annuity business for him. And it's going to take a week or two to get back to a customer that's looking for instantaneous engagement, instantaneous gratification, a policy, right?
So people weren't representing you well to the people who are taking pictures. So it's going to be harder to get more photos and more customers.
Correct.
I get why you'd want to go off on your own.
Yeah.
What goes into doing that? You need to get licensed. You need to get a lot. You need how much money in the bank per?
We're primarily a distribution business, and we're starting to underwrite some of our own products and take risk on those. But it's capital light, right? Like it's why the multiples on distribution businesses are so much better than typical carriers.
It's capital light.
It's capital light. Like I don't need to hold any capital in reserve because I'm not taking on any risk, right? I'm acting as a sophisticated frontline underwriter. A customer comes in through cover. We're the ones that the product acts as a sieve and a filtering mechanism for bad risks. It's quite simple. I mean, you authenticate in, you're asked a couple of insurance related questions. You're asked for proof of insurability. So pictures and videos of things you want to insure. And then we search the entire insurance market. We literally have, we represent 30 insurance carriers across the country, operate in 49 states. So we're very competitive.
Got it. That's the part where you become the broker yourself. You don't need heavy capital for, where you take risk? At what point did you switch to that?
Yeah. So we, because we have such broad coverage, are in this unique position to identify pockets of profitability, right? Like we can say, hey, like in this particular state for this line of business, we're competitive for these people. We're not competitive for these people. And we think we can be profitable there. What you'll see over the course of the next couple months, we haven't announced any of this stuff yet, but you'll see us coming up with bespoke products that you can just buy. Right.
Like, what? You don't have to give me one that you're specifically going to publish.
We sell auto, home, pets, jewelry, electronics, coverage for electronics, just about like
home insurance. You guys are backing it. So if something happens and someone steals from my house, the money's coming from you, or you're sending it out like a broker would.
So we're not doing home, but the way that you would end up doing home, as a startup is you'd most likely do it via something called an MGA relationships, managing general agent. It's where you source the customers. So you're identifying the customers that you want to get onto your book. You're underwriting the customers. So you're designing the insurance product. You're pricing the insurance product. But you're selling that risk onto a panel of reinsurers. So reinsurance is like insurance for insurance, right? And so you pay the reinsurer a premium, some part of the overall premium dollar. And in return, they take on the risk. And they take on the risk because that home insurance risk is just one set of risks amongst a plethora of things that are uncorrelated.
Okay. Right?
And so they can do it that way. But that's typically speaking how you would do it in a very capital light way. Holding balance sheet risk is the profile of capital necessary to do that is very different than venture. You raise a venture to fund operating losses, like to grow. Whereas the capital that you need to hold in reserve for insurance purposes is regulatory capital, right? Like it's pretty safe and you don't need to raise it from VCs.
So then what do you have that other people in the, say, auto insurance space don't have? I know what Geico has. They have a brand name that's so well known that when you mentioned them a few times, people knew what they were. They have a lot of brand equity. So when you see the Geico Gecko, you kind of connect to it. Mm-hmm. They're buying and bidding up every Google AdWord, them and their competition. Yeah, when you come in, what's your advantage that allows you to stand out?
We're lucky. We're lucky that our customers are, the average age is 28 and they don't care about insurance brand as it stands. And so when you go through the entire cover process, so let's use a stylized example of car insurance. When you make a car insurance request through cover, all we're doing is trying to figure out what your profile is. Like, hey, like, what's your occupation? Like, what's your estimated, like, earnings? What are your exposures going to look like? Do you own a home? So if you hit somebody with your car, is that person going to go after your house and your savings? Like,
right.
So what we're doing is we're calibrating the coverage level to the exposure. Right. And so for you, we'd be like, okay, here's the exact price and the exact limits that we would suggest for you. We don't actually share the brand of the carrier they're working with. And it could be Progressive, it could be Travelers, it could be Safeco, it could be any one of these insurance companies. All we care about is making sure that your exposures are covered off at the end of the day, right? And so inserting a cover product into that you know set of carriers is actually trivial. But you're right. You know, right. Like most insurance companies compete on the back of general awareness, right? And I think, you know, our focus has been primarily to simplify the onboarding experience, to make it super pleasurable, make sure the servicing and modification of any insurance policy that you buy through us is super simple via in-app messaging. So if you look at our reviews, like we do exactly what we're going
to
say.
That's exactly, if you saw my eyes go down, yeah. That's exactly what I was trying to do, trying to see the reviews. But here's a weird thing that came up. If I search for cover in the App Store, you guys don't come up. If I search for cover.com, you guys don't come up.
Wait, sorry, you're on the iOS?
iOS App Store. If I search for cover.
Which country are you in?
US.
That's so weird. Hold on. Look, watch.
Oh, now it came up. Oh, I wonder what I did before. I definitely did. Now it came up. I got the story for cover before, which includes like how to buy a home. Now it's coming up. I don't know. That was kind of.
Yeah, now it's right there, man.
Yeah. Weird. Okay. All right.
Yeah, we're featured right now. And we actually just launched the most recent version of cover. So you should try it out. It's pretty nice. I think it's going to win an Apple Design Award in an iteration or two.
So you do have a lot of reviews. I wanted to see what people were saying. I get it. I like it. I wonder, is it all now App Store? No, it's not. What are you doing to get people in?
Yeah, no, actually it is all App Store. So it's like, hey, it's partly ASO. Like if you were to search for insurance on Google Play, for example, we rank one or two in the United States on any given day.
Because you are better at App Store optimization.
And we're better at building product than just about everyone in insurance. Like that's the truth. I mean, and you think about where we came from, e-commerce, which is viciously competitive, and all of a sudden we're building product into a space and then specifically into a channel where there hasn't been any competition. I mean, we had a head start day one, right? And so that's been helpful. But I mean, our differentiators are we're fast, we're cheap, we don't spam people, we let you make up your mind in and around the purchase decision. We sell all of our policies via in-app messaging and SMS.
I'm going to do it. You start all of it with what?
In-app messaging. We sell up all of our policies via in-app messaging and SMS.
I'm actually trying to get like a quote right now because there's something I want to bring up. I can actually take a picture. Can't I take a picture of the computer that you and I are on? And I'll get a check mark that says the computer is there. That it processes? Does that work?
Yeah. So that was actually version 2 where we use a TensorFlow-based camera and you could walk around your house and we would identify the individual pieces of property and catalog that against your homeowner's policy. I don't think, so for this current version, we're pairing it back because we're moving to Core ML. So the Apple's native framework. For machine, like computer vision and machine learning. And so you'll see
that. I would be able to still scan stuff. You'll see the sofa. You'll know this is a sofa.
Exactly.
We're going to insure it. You tell me how much a sofa is worth. We'll insure it.
Actually, from our perspective, all it really is a tool for the customer. Like one, it helps us, be sure that the property exists in a given time, place, and condition, right? That's important. As part of an underwriting process. But for the customer, it means that when you're dealing with an adjuster, say like God forbid your house burns down, like you're no longer battling back and forth with an adjuster around whether that 4K TV was this one or that one or what have you. Because insurance companies, typically speaking, are not in the business of paying out, which is why their NPS scores are pretty crap. Right. And so here we are effectively empowering the customer with proof, right, that the property exists in a given time, place, and condition. And you know how we actually came up with this idea? It was like insurance brokers of old would ask their customers when they bought home insurance policies to grab their camcorder, pop in a VHS tape.
Yeah.
Like walk around the outside of the house, walk around the inside of the house, grab that tape, put it into a safety deposit box. Like that is literally what they would ask their customers.
Oh, I didn't realize that that's what they would do before. Put it in a safety deposit box and that way they know.
If your house burned down, you don't want to,
right?
And so, yeah, I mean, they did this and we were like, okay, well, we're a tech company. We'd probably build something a little better than that. And off we went to do that. Exactly. And so what you'll see is future versions of cover will be able to resolve damage on vehicles.
But I can't now use this to just take a picture of my computer and insure my computer. It's got to be a homeowner's insurance or a renter's insurance, and the computer's part of that.
Right.
Got it. And essentially what you're selling are three different, no, it should be four. Mm-hmm. Car insurance, homeowner insurance, renter insurance, and pet insurance, which I don't see in the app right now.
So this version, you're going to see a release shortly that has pet jewelry. And we usually have a section called Surprise Us, which is where we see people throw in all sorts of crazy stuff.
And that's how you get a sense of what else should we be doing.
Yeah.
Can I insure my feet? I got to run all around the world. I'm a little worried. I remember how you used to see Lloyd's of London would insure somebody's arms or their breasts or something or their legs. Does that happen?
No. Well, I mean, is there an opportunity for some sort of economic loss if you were to?
There is.
I guess so, right? Like, yeah.
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 But the economic gain for me running around the world is pretty minimal. It's
no. I mean, it's supposed to be downside protection, right? So if there is an actual downside, I think you probably get a policy.
Are you thinking that way? Like, how can we get more media by insuring something crazy?
Yeah, no, I mean, you actually do see some of these articles that pop up, like Lloyd's of London, like insured J-Lo's legs, or like Taylor Swift's butt, or like something like that, right? I mean, those are interesting. Those are the exception, not the rule, right? Like typical people do not, like normal people don't care about those types of things.
Why are you doing this interview with me? What's in it for you? I'm looking to try to get a sense of maybe you're getting traffic from a bunch of podcasters. No. You did get some from TechCrunch. That's big. YC List seems to have sent you some traffic.
Yeah,
majority of traffic is coming from Google.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, we're pretty good at SEO. We're starting to get good at SEO. So that's good. Then the reason for that is actually it's a lead up to us launching cover.com. So I bought this very expensive domain because I wanted to market.
How much?
Stupidly expensive. It was $750K.
Wow. All right. Yeah, and it's a perfect fit for you.
I get it. Well, look, like, you know, I actually get a lot of flack, like on Hacker News and via the YC community for doing something like this, because it's like antithetical to, being a scrappy startup, as you aptly described very early on. I think the reason for it is this. I have a very, very good understanding of what the underlying economic model of my business is, right? I know that right now, I have to be very surgical. We talked a little bit about how we are about acquiring customers at a reasonable cost and building up a decent sized book of business. But I also know that Cover at some point or another is going to be competing on general awareness, right? Like Geico and State Farm.
Right.
If we're going to be writing millions of new policies a year, that's inevitably going to happen, right? Well, discoverability and name recall matters, right? At that point. So if you have a $2,000 LTV for a customer, right? Minor variations in conversion rates have huge outcomes, right? When N is large. And so if that's like that's actually the context for the buy. It was like, okay, well, I know discoverability matters. I know that I'm probably going to get it the cheapest it's ever going to be. If we announce our Series A or our Series B, it's going to be much more expensive. And we think this is probably a brand or the brand that we want to build around. It's something that we think we can be proud of, but also the economics, a couple thousand policies in makes sense, right? Like it's fairly trivial for something like, if you think of it in the context of how much premium you'd be writing.
So then what's the goal of being here? I like how methodical you are. You even thought through that name. What's the advantage of being here? Is this like an SEO play to be here? Is this?
No. I mean, I actually like
legit. It's great for me. I just want to
enjoy having these conversations. I think it's cool to share our story. It's certainly an opportunity for me to talk about that. Sometimes it's an opportunity for me to get outside of my own head and be a little creative, and be asked questions that are interesting. And I appreciate you doing that. How else would I be spending my, Wednesday evening in Greensboro, North Carolina?
You'd be enjoying the hotel room. Just be away.
After meeting with reinsurers.
Right? Is that what you were doing? Meeting with reinsurers?
Yeah, actually.
And then you get into the hotel room with me. Can you turn the camera around? Can I get a sense of how much you're spending on a hotel room? Let's see if you're at luxury.
This is Hyatt Place. It's like $79 a night.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty good price. You make your bed? Is your bed? No, of course the bed is made up. When I'm in hotels, I have to make the bed even before I leave the room. Right. Everything has to be put away. I know what it is. Yeah, yeah. I want everything organized when I'm away.
Yeah. You know, there was a recent trip to New York that I took to meet with one of our investors. And like they balled out. They own like a building on like Fifth Avenue. They invited me to this like super fancy party. And I was only there for something like 18 hours. So I flew from San Francisco to New York. And I was like, well, I don't want to pay $500 for a hotel room. And so I got, and I kid you not, I mean, this is like harking back to when I was in college. I got a spot in a shared Airbnb room with like four other people, like one of those quads.
Yep.
that costs like $80 a night. And I was fine with it. I mean, I was like, okay. It was maybe a little hot and sweaty, but I dealt. I slept like 4 hours and I was back on a flight, and that's what it is. So I mean, you shouldn't do that. Like in retrospect, I was like, that's just dumb. Like, yeah, it's dumb because it's like, I probably should put a better price on like what my comfort and like my ability to function is, you know?
Yeah.
So like if you're in a room with four other like backpackers, and you're sleeping for 4 hours, you're probably not going to get that much done the next day. Right.
And the shower is never going to be as free. And
yeah. Clean, like. And like you described the economic value of, you know, the work that you're actually doing the next day, and the math doesn't really work. Right.
I don't know something. So when I go to conferences, I rent the nicest fucking luxury hotel room that I can get, the suite, because I want to have a bunch of people come in. And so you justify it. The numbers absolutely pay off. But on the nights that I'm in these rooms, I am so much more inspired, so much like more productive for being in that environment, that I wonder if it'd just be worth it just for that. There's something about that. Like the room that you were talking about.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. I've had a suite like once. I was a managing consultant, so I held a bunch of points, and like I used them to get a suite. I'm pretty frugal when it comes to stuff that I spend for on myself.
All right. Here's what I learned. Number one, most insurance websites, they're actually not the worst, but they're not great. Like Geico does have an app that works, but it doesn't work the way that I do, and I don't know how to put my finger on it. And somehow your app does. It's little things. Number one. Number two thing that I learned was when you were going back in time and evaluating cutting your hair, which would have been really tough for me. I had long hair when I was a kid just because I was into heavy metal. Cutting it was really tough. I like your attitude about it, which is, no, it is all compost. It may not be the same exact thing that grows from this compost, but something's going to grow better because the compost is there. I really love the way that you put that. I like how you went against this industry that is really, really full of money. And you came at it from a very techie point of view, like how do we do better app store optimization? How do we create a cleaner, simpler app? That type of thing was really inspiring to see. And I like what you learned from Shopify and what you brought into Shopify about doing like this surgery. How would you call your marketing approach? The idea that Shopify would create these add-on services that you basically would need before you need Shopify as a way of getting you into Shopify.
Yeah, they call it pre-commerce. We call it pre-insurance.
Pre-insurance and pre-commerce and pre-marketing sounds like a great avenue to go down. And I love the examples that you had for it. All right. For anyone who wants to go check out your website, hey, get this. It's really super easy. I'm a horrible speller. Even I could spell it. Cover.com. And I think I know what I did in the app store. I did cover and then said, do you want the story? So I said, yes, I want the story. Mm-hmm. And then all I got was a story. All right. So cover.com for anyone who wants to go check them out. And I want to thank my two sponsors who made this interview happen. First, hostgator.com/Mixergy for hosting your website. Right. Really don't overthink it, guys. Hostgator.com/Mixergy. And if you ever have a bad experience with them, email me and my team, contact@Mixergy.com. We always want to know about it, but we've been watching this. People are just producing good websites and moving on. Hostgator.com/Mixergy. Number one. Number two, if you need to hire a developer like I did or Karn did and so many other people who listen to Mixergy, man, Karn, it must be a lot, which is why they keep every year asking if they could buy every single ad we have. It's working for them. It'll work for you. Go to toptal.com/Mixergy. And finally, if my foot does not, I'm going to the doctor soon. I've got to go check it out. I'm running a marathon on every single continent all over the world. North America, South America, Europe, whatever else there is. I'm going to be running a marathon there, interviewing entrepreneurs along the way. If you want to see my progress and get on calls with me about like what your goal is, what my goal is throughout the year, I want this to be the best year we've ever had. Go check out runwithandrew.com and you'll get to jump on calls with me. Karn, thanks so much for doing this interview. I really like talking to you.
Yeah, man. This was awesome. Thanks so much for hosting me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks. Bye, everyone.